This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In the winter, we dare to ask, why did global warming pause? New science shows it didn't. Official records grossly underestimated real heating here on Earth. You'll hear that science unfold. What else has been lowballed? The US EPA estimates of dangerous methane emissions in America. Our guest explains just released science showing humans are emitting 1.5 times more than the government told you. We'll wrap up the show with the climate-related death of another dream, the economy of the southern states. Why is the storm belt withering? I'm Alex Smith. Get ready for Radio EcoShock. Scientists have been pondering why all our carbon was not showing up as higher temperatures. While extreme weather seems on the increase, climate change deniers are talking about a long pause in warming. Two Canadian scientists have finally figured out where the heat is. We've reached Robert Way, a doctoral student at the University of Ottawa, along with University of York computational scientist Kevin Cowton. Robert just published a startling study in the Quarterly Journal of the Royal Meteorological Society. They've got scientists talking and media calling from all over the world after finding planet Earth is warming more than twice the previously accepted figures. Robert Way is from Labrador in Canada's north, and Robert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Before we get technical, what is the big problem you and Kevin set out to solve?
I should start out at the outset and say that Kevin Cowton is from the University of York in the United Kingdom, not in Canada. There is a York University in Canada, but he's from the UK, so just figured I'd clarify that. The problem that, in essence, we've tried to find a solution to, or at least improve upon, is simply a matter of, in several of the most recent types of global temperature analysis, there's been a gap in the Arctic and in other parts of the world where they did not have observational stations. And our goal was to, in essence, simply find a manner of being able to better estimate how temperatures are changing in those regions. And ultimately, it led to this startling result that you've described. But the actual project itself was simply aimed at better understanding how temperatures have changed in some of these isolated regions in the Antarctic, in the Arctic, in Africa, etc.
Previous calculations of global warming showed only 0.5 degree rise per decade since the 1990s, let's say. And I know scientists bend over backwards trying to find out where the heat went, with the consensus being that it went into the oceans. Where was it really?
Well, I think it's been an interesting year, certainly, in that you've seen a few studies that have been published on. Yes, there's been the one regarding the PDO and the ocean. There's been several other alternatives proposed, like that there's been more volcanism, that there's been more human aerosol generation and things like that. For us, our result simply shows that over the past 15 years, the majority of the warming that has occurred in the Arctic, and the Arctic has warmed at a rate that's been 8 times the rest of the planet. And I think we've seen certainly the results of this in the dramatic reductions in sea ice and also in changes to glaciers and in ice core records, which are showing very high melt rates now, especially in the eastern Canadian Arctic. So our study is simply a matter of we've found that the Arctic is warming quicker than the rest of the planet by a significant margin. And this is something other scientists have known, but I believe in the case of using the global temperature records we've used, we're the first to actually put an exact number as to what kind of underestimation was occurring.
It seems wild that leading institutions from NASA to Hadley to Potsdam might have missed what you found. How is that possible?
Just to say at the outset, I wouldn't say they've missed it. I know that, for instance, Hadley in the United Kingdom, their Met Office, they released a memo 2 or 3 years ago where they actually said straight out that their observational database, because it's incomplete in the Arctic, they assume that they are catching the bottom end of the warming. And that was in their own release. Now, they didn't quantify what that meant, but they said, based on their paper that they produced, that they know that they're missing some warming in the Arctic. NASA, they use a different method. NASA does interpolate, so they estimate the temperatures at the polar regions, and they incorporate that into their model. Our record, using the Hadley database, we have more than twice the rate of warming, but we're a lot closer to NASA's record. And frankly, if NASA was using a, let's say there's still a remaining bias in some sea surface temperature records that they have not incorporated yet, but that Hadley has, when they incorporate that, their trends will come in very similar to ours, or that's what our preliminary tests have found, for NASA at least. For both NOAA and for the Met Office in the UK, both of their temperature records don't include the Arctic for the most part.
So the IPCC, though, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they've been reporting the low end as well all this time. Is that so?
Well, when they use these particular temperature databases, such as Hadley, such as NOAA, they do also include NASA. But when they use those databases, in essence, they were showing the low end. And what they were missing was certainly some degree of that warming that was occurring in the Arctic in particular.
Well, how much has it warmed in the last decade or 15 years? What's the rate?
Well, the rate in the Arctic has been at 8 times the global average. The global average temperature in our record has been at about 0.12 degrees per decade. By comparison, the initial estimate from the Met Office data was around 0.05. So ours is up over 2 times the rate of warming recorded in the Met Office data, and the Arctic is warming at 8 times that rate. So it's a very quick rate in the Arctic, certainly. And this is, in particular, you know, the last decade we've seen very much so what the impacts of a rapidly warming Arctic can be. Our corrected record is at 0.12.
Okay. Well, we have an educated audience here at Radio EcoShock, but none of us is really ready for the extreme math and the super specialist terms that you would have had to dive into. Can you break down for us how you did make this discovery?
Well, I believe the simplest way of really describing it is that in the Arctic, there are certainly some areas that do have observational databases. And so for those remote weather stations, be they in Greenland, be they in the Canadian Arctic, et cetera, we know that the rate of warming was very quick. We know that the temperatures have risen quite quickly. The challenge that we had was, if you have two isolated weather stations, how do you know what's occurred in between there? Is, for instance, the area relatively homogeneous, or is there a lot of heterogeneity? For our method, we decided to incorporate satellite data. We actually provided two methods. We provided one where we simply made an estimate using a form of geostatistical interpolation, and then we provided a second method, which is using satellites to actually guide the interpolation. So we still were using the observational databases to estimate what temperatures were how temperatures were changing in the Arctic, but we used satellite measurements to guide how that interpolation went. So in essence, if we had one weather station located in a remote area, another one located quite a distance away, say 500 kilometers away, using the satellite data, we could say, yes, in between those two areas was also warming at a similar rate. And so then that actually helped us guide in our estimations. So that's one part of the method. Now, the most important part of the method, and the part that you certainly won't see mentioned very often on those websites where they're criticizing the paper and whatnot, is that we also used what's called holdout cross-validation. So we actually reduced the global coverage of the observational record and used our method to estimate what the temperatures would be in all those areas where we actually do have weather stations. Now, this was, so that we could compare what our estimate would have been to what the actual weather station data said for there. And when we did so, we found that certainly using the interpolation method was good, but that the satellite method was vastly superior. And and that we actually reduce the error significantly versus doing what Hadley does, which is if they have an area that is that they don't have a station in, they just leave it out. Well, when you do that, when you leave out, say, an observation because you don't have a station there, then you're assuming that that point is changing temperature at the same as the rest of the globe. Because mathematically speaking, that's what you're doing. And so, in essence, say if you have in the Arctic, if you have all these points in the Arctic that you don't know how quickly the temperature is changing there, and you leave them out, you're assuming that that's all happening at the global average. Now, we know based on a myriad of different sources of evidence that the Arctic tends to have quite a difference from what the actual global average does. And so that in itself provided another means. You know, not only do we use this cross-validation, not only do you use our satellite method, but also whether the results even make sense. And that's an important part of the science as well.
Hearing from you that we're lacking some of the information that we need, and I can't help but wonder, I mean, Canada is a fossil fuel producer, so is Russia. Are we lacking enough research to really know how fast the world is warming? Do we need more research in that?
Well, my own personal view is that certainly, let's say in the last 5 years, there have been a lot, in Canada in particular, there's been a lot of cuts to Arctic research. And that's problematic because, you know, there are certainly a lot of regions there that we still need a better understanding about. And when you cut away research funding, when you cut away positions like with Environment Canada, all those kinds of things, then it ends up that there tends to be a backlog. And the information that scientists need to better inform policymakers just doesn't get out in the same way. And that's a challenge. Now, there are groups that are doing some very good work in terms of trying to collate together as much information as possible. The Met Office group, they have their database, but there are other groups that are assembling larger ones. So I presume that when we actually have those larger databases completely put together and quality controlled and all those things, that we will be able to even have stronger confidence in the results of our studies and other studies in the Arctic. And there are certainly a lot of observational sources that are out there. It's just a matter of combining them all together. And that's always the problem. Data assimilation is a big issue and something that there are a few groups working on.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with University of Ottawa researcher Robert Way. And as you say, Robert, in addition to the major news stories in newspapers like Britain's Independent, your paper stirred up a lot of talk in the climate scientists hangout at realclimate.org, for example. And the critics, some of whom represent fossil fuel interests, granted, took a shot at your credentials being only a postdoc. Has the scientific world tended to block out important work from a new generation of climate researchers?
I have to clarify, I'm a PhD student, not a postdoc, just for clarity purposes. But I think that it's always challenging when it comes to doing research in climate science because, to be honest, you know, you don't go to a university, generally speaking, and do a PhD in climate science. You tend to do it in other things. A lot of people who are climate scientists have physics backgrounds, a lot of geophysics, meteorology, geography. You'd be surprised just how many climatologists are in geography departments, et cetera. So you kind of take these things with a grain of salt. When you see somebody who is using an attack on someone's credentials as a means of trying to dissuade others away from a particular paper, et cetera, that's usually an indication that they don't have a better argument to fall on. And that's what you see. When people attack, say, our credentials or for not being terribly active in the climate science community, it's for me, I don't really read much into it. And certainly the other thing about it is that, you know, Kevin Cowtan, the lead author of this particular paper, he's very well published in his field, which is computational science. He's got a lot of papers and some ones that have been incredibly highly cited, and he's a fantastic computational scientist. And so certainly in climate science now, a lot of the direction it has moved in is obviously in using computer modeling and using computational type work. So certainly when you take people who have that kind of stats background, that kind of background in computational science, and put them in climate science, it's always a benefit rather than something that detracts away from the work.
I'd also like to talk to you about permafrost. My eyes lit up when I saw you've worked with one of the giants of permafrost, Dr. Anthony Lukowitz. He's been a guest on Radio EcoShock. For our listeners all over the world, in general terms, what is permafrost and why does it matter?
Well, permafrost is, in essence, ground that's been frozen for two consecutive years. And in general, it's often much, much longer. And in some places in the world, there's permafrost that's been frozen for hundreds of thousands of years, certainly in areas that weren't glaciated during the last ice age. Permafrost is important for a myriad of reasons, and in particular in, say, Arctic regions and near Arctic communities. When permafrost degradation occurs, there are a lot of issues that actually affect people. And where I'm from in northern Canada, there's been a lot of communities that have had a lot of issues. When permafrost thaws, ground settles, you get movement. And so one of the challenges is when you build in permafrost, you have things like sometimes the road might collapse, you have buildings that can collapse, you have all those types of issues. And then added to that, compounding the importance of permafrost, you also look at, there are certainly large areas of permafrost that contain a great deal of methane. And certainly when you thaw permafrost, that methane is released into the atmosphere. And as we all know, that's also a greenhouse gas and a very powerful one. So certainly there's a bunch of reasons. There's a lot of reasons to study permafrost. And I know that in the popular media now, it seems that there's more of a focus towards the understanding better the way methane may impact our futures.
I'd like to get back to the methane thing, but you know, when I was at a recording of a panel discussion of permafrost at the 2012 meeting of the National Academy of Science, the consensus there was that permafrost melts on a relatively long timescale, like at least hundreds of years. Are we seeing changes faster than that?
Well, I would say that, say, a large region of continuous permafrost will take a very long time to thaw. The challenge is not in necessarily those areas of continuous, although there are challenges. When it's at that threshold where it goes from continuous to discontinuous, that's a problem. But it's really at the southern end of say, the discontinuous zone, where permafrost is not everywhere, but it's in certain spots. And those types of areas can be very sensitive to change. So if you take an area that, say, has permafrost, the annual air temperature is -3, and you warm that area so that the air temperature is close to zero, then it can have quite an impact on the permafrost, and most of it will disappear, and it can happen quickly, and certainly the impacts can happen quickly. Now, whether if you have very deep permafrost in an area, and if, let's say, that region you have something built on top of, say you have a road built on top of, the permafrost doesn't need to thaw to the base of the permafrost for it to cause impacts at the surface. It's, you know, the second you get any thawing, you can have slumping, you can have all these types of impacts that are very important. Whether all permafrost disappears from a particular region or not, that's on the human time scale, that's not as relevant as simply the impacts that can happen.
Well, you know, Robert, some people in North America's crowded cities, and some of our listeners probably, imagine that if the world overheats the way it's been predicted, they'll just move into Canada's north. And, we laugh because I know there's poor soils, there's land made unstable by permafrost, as we're talking about, there's the absence of winter sun and lots of insects. It's harder than anyone would think. What's your opinion?
Well, I'm from northern Canada, and I'll say that certainly there are challenges, let's say, with living in those regions. I really love the north, but I think that not everybody is suited for it, let's say. And you know, I laugh when you mentioned the last part regarding insects. I will say that northern Canada, particularly the wooded areas, are it's a difficult working there sometimes, let's say.
It's a real challenge. I've been there myself. Now, if there was a methane burst, as some scientists have predicted is possible, or if there was a sudden increase in global temperature, could we measure and prove that in real time, or would the accounting come in a year or two later after we've seen big events in the north and around the world?
I have to be absolutely honest. I'm not an expert on methane and certainly permafrost contributions to methane concentrations. So I'd rather not speak to that a whole lot because I don't know. I know there are a lot of individuals who are out there who are very much monitoring this and, you know, have set up more or less real-time monitoring in some areas of things like methane emissions from a deep or a subsea permafrost and whatnot. But I would much rather if these types of questions were addressed to the real experts on that subject.
Good enough. Well, now, as we wrap up, Robert Way, is there anything else that you would like to talk to us about?
Well, the one thing I would like to say with respect to certainly our paper is the goal was we decided to put the paper in a specialist journal, so it got very tough scrutiny, certainly from experts. It was a very long review process. And we decided to make all our data and all our code that we used to generate it accessible to the public right at the outset. We're working on making the paper open and fully accessible. I don't believe it's done today, but it will be accessible very soon, that it's freely available. Our hope is by making everything available, by making all of this accessible by other scientists and by other, let's say, amateur scientists, that we can in some ways find ways of improving on our work and ultimately better being able to describe global temperature. Our goal is not to be the final word on this particular subject. Our goal is to open the conversation and help the development of methods so that we can really see ourselves moving forward in let's say, a positive way. We want to see other people criticize our work. As long as it's fair criticisms, we want to see other people replicate our work. The ultimate goal is that 5 years from now, we have a completely robust way of monitoring global temperatures. And I think that our paper is simply a first step in that direction.
From the Geography Department, University of Ottawa in Canada, Robert Ray co-authored a paper that found global warming is at least twice the previously published figures. Robert, what is the title of your new co-authored paper for people who want to look it up?
Our paper is called Coverage Bias in the Hadcroot 4 Temperature Series and its impacts on recent temperature trends. I should mention we also have a website available. It's called Coverage Bias in the Hadcroot 4 Temperature Record. And this website has a briefing document. It has some videos because we've actually made some YouTube videos. Certainly we have a 3.5-minute abstract that gives a description of what we do and has some nice visualizations. On this website, you can also find the methods, the data, the actual series itself, a link to the paper, and also we have a frequently asked questions section that we've put up, which is in response to some of the questions we've already received from other scientists and other individuals. So we've already updated that. I think we've got about 10 frequently asked questions, and we have short descriptions and then longer ones giving detailed answers to some of the questions we received.
Well, that sounds like a goldmine. I'll ask you to email me that link, and I'll put that and some links to other discussion about this paper in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Robert Way, thank you so much for talking with Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having the time to talk to me today.
Big Picture Radio right now with Alex Smith. Get it all, ecoshock.org. A new university study shows emissions of the dangerous greenhouse gas methane are much higher than the American government reports. Have artificially low figures protected the American cattle industry and fossil fuel producers? Joining us is Scott M. Miller. He's from the Department of Earth and Planetary Science at Harvard. Scott is the lead author of a paper just published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science titled Anthropogenic Emissions of Methane in the United States. Dr. Miller, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me on the show today.
There's been a growing concern, as you know, about methane leaking out of the melting Arctic, and that's why it's alarming to find the government agencies, like the Environmental Protection Agency, may have been underestimating real methane emissions in the lower 48 states. Why did your group undertake a new look at this?
I think we really came across this project a little bit by happenstance. It's really interesting that you mention methane leaking out of a melting Arctic because that was really the first question that we were interested in. We had an undergraduate in our group. Her name is Talia Havis, and she was investigating methane emissions from Arctic and boreal regions of Canada, you know, really cold parts of Canada with lots and lots of wetlands that emit methane in the atmosphere. You know, we have collaborators here in the United States that are also taking measurements of methane in the atmosphere. And I had sort of thought, well, you know, why don't we try to do a similar type of analysis over the U.S. and see what we find there? And I think a lot of the results really surprised us that we saw such high methane emissions, and in particular that we saw such high emissions over places like, you know, Texas and Oklahoma in the U.S.
And you measured those from planes and high towers, that sort of thing?
Yeah, yep, that's correct. So our colleagues at NOAA, which is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and DOE, the Department of Energy, take these measurements of methane gas in the atmosphere. So they take air samples from the top of telecommunications towers, and a lot of these towers are the height of the Empire State Building or taller. So they're really high up there in the atmosphere, or rather high up above the ground. And we also take air samples from airplanes and measure methane gas in those samples. So the sort of principle or the idea behind our study is that all methane that's emitted at the surface eventually goes into the atmosphere. So when we're measuring methane gas concentrations in the atmosphere, we're really seeing the amalgamated signal of methane gas emissions over a regional scale. And, you know, using these measurements of methane gas in the atmosphere, we can get a pretty good estimate of total emissions of the gas over, say, a region or over the entire United States.
And the bottom line is, how much more methane is America emitting than the EPA reports?
Our estimate of methane gas emissions is 1.5 times that of the U.S. EPA. And I'll give you a little bit more context on that number. The states of California and Massachusetts, for example, have required reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. And both states are requiring about a 15% reduction from current levels by the year 2020. In contrast, you know, the discrepancy between our study and the U.S. EPA's estimate is more along the lines of 50%, and 50% is a whole lot greater than 15%.
Well, Scott, why don't we break this down a bit? I know many of my listeners suspect fracking is a major source. Were you able to determine that?
Unfortunately, we were not able to get a specific number of methane from fracking, and I know that's really been an issue that's been a point of public debate recently. When we measure methane gas in the atmosphere, we're measuring the accumulated effect of all methane emissions over a broad region. And so that means that we get a pretty good idea of total methane emissions, but on the other hand, it means that we can't really tell whether, you know, most of that gas is coming from a certain cattle farm or a certain oil and gas facility or from a certain landfill. We just see the effect of all of these different sources together.
Do the south central states like Louisiana or Texas or Oklahoma show up more on the methane map than other places?
Yeah, you've really hit on, I think, one thing that we found most striking about our results. We find the highest emissions of methane gas in the atmosphere over places like Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Kansas. A former PhD student in our group had used some methane measurements from aircraft a few years ago. His name is Eric Court. And in a 2008 study, he estimated total methane gas emissions over the United States. And we sort of had a good idea from his study that total U.S. methane emissions were higher than estimates from the EPA. But what we've really learned from this study, which I think is new and surprised all of us, is how important the states of Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Kansas are in U.S. methane emissions. And in fact, Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas alone account for about a quarter of all U.S. methane emissions in our estimate.
Well, beyond fracking, there's a ton of refining in the states like Texas. We have a listing of their emissions in that global methane inventory called EDGAR. Are those numbers accurate?
You're correct. There is a lot of refining in these states, and particularly in Texas, like you point out. Using our methodology, we get some idea that ruminants, and that refers to cows and sheep, and also the oil and gas industries as a whole, are probably part of the big discrepancy in methane emissions over places like Texas and Oklahoma. But we don't really get specific information about refining. The reason why we think that the oil and gas industries as a whole are important contributors is because of a really important gas called propane that we're able to measure in the atmosphere. So our colleagues at NOAA measure methane, as we had talked about before, but they also measure a gas in the atmosphere called propane. And it turns out that propane is a product of the oil and gas industries, but it's not produced by cows, it's not produced by wetlands, it's not produced by most other emitters. And it turns out that in places like Texas and Oklahoma, when we see high propane levels in the atmosphere, we also see high methane levels in the atmosphere. And similarly, when we see low propane levels, we also see low methane levels. So we think that the oil and gas industries as a whole are an important player in these regions in Texas and Oklahoma. But, you know, whether those emissions are coming from refineries or from the well sites, it's not entirely clear.
And as you point out, it's not just fossil fuels. The cattle industry is a well-known source of this super greenhouse gas, methane. Can you talk to us about that?
So the United States Environmental Protection Agency estimates greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. And they update their estimate every year. And some years they list ruminants, cows and sheep, for example, and manure management as being the largest source of methane in the U.S. And other years they list the oil and gas industries as being the largest source of methane in the United States. So these two sources are really competing for being the dominant sources of methane in the U.S. most likely. And we think that the amount of methane coming out of cows is much higher than what existing emissions inventories have estimated. And here's why. We estimate methane emissions over all of the U.S. And in particular, we can focus in on places that have a lot of cows, but that don't have a whole lot of other methane-emitting activities. States like South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, all of those places have a lot of cows, but obviously not a lot of oil or gas drilling or a whole lot of people that might be producing methane. And in those areas, we see about twice the amount, or we estimate about twice the amount of methane emissions than in existing emissions inventories. And so that would lead us to believe that there's probably some sort of discrepancy with cows.
And as your paper points out, the EPA recently reduced its estimates of emissions from the natural gas industry. Was that the right move?
That's a really good question. Our estimate of methane, total methane emissions over the United States is much, much higher than U.S. EPA's estimate. It's hard to conceive how EPA's recent downward revision in methane emissions would be consistent with the actual measurements of methane that we've taken in the atmosphere. So we don't think that it was the right move. Again, we don't have specific information in our report on the natural gas industry, but it's hard to imagine how this reduction from EPA could be consistent with what we're actually seeing in the atmosphere.
Well, the cows would have to be producing a lot to get the extra that you found. Okay, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking methane emissions from America, the new numbers in a scientific study. Our guest is Harvard's Scott Miller. Scott, your paper lists methane as the second most important greenhouse gas forced into the atmosphere by human activity. And you say it is, quote, approximately one-third the total radiative forcing of carbon dioxide. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so when we're sort of thinking about greenhouse gases and climate change in general, there are a lot of different players and a lot of different actors. You know, there are a number of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. You know, one of them obviously being carbon dioxide, another is methane. Another one that's commonly talked about is another gas called nitrous oxide. But out of all the different greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, long-lived greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide in particular is of primary concern. And the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, estimates that methane globally has about one-third the contribution to climate change as carbon dioxide.
I find that interesting because I remember James Hansen in the Bush years when oil was not even to be talked about and carbon dioxide. He came up with a plan that he thought could at least halt short-term warming by controlling methane. And I hope to talk to you at the end of this about some of the things that we could be doing about methane. But I discovered something I didn't know in your paper. Again, in addition to pushing climate change, higher methane levels can also damage human health through smog. How does that work?
One particular acute health hazard in many places in the United States and throughout the world is surface-level ozone. Ozone way up in the atmosphere is, in the stratosphere, is very beneficial. But down at the surface, where humans actually live, ozone can be much more damaging to human health. ozone can be produced by a bunch of different chemicals in the atmosphere. For example, one important player, or one of the most important players, are nitrogen-containing compounds that are released by cars and trucks and many other human sources that are found throughout big cities in the United States. But it turns out that methane can also interact with this sort of big, complicated chemical cycle in order to produce more ozone. A lot of times we usually think of, you know, the chemicals coming out of cars and trucks as being most important in this sort of health hazard. Methane can also play a role. It's not as big of a role, but it's still an important role.
Scott, I mentioned fears of Arctic methane emissions, but Dr. David Archer on this program, he's from the University of Chicago, he continues to say methane from the subtropics, including the United States, is a larger threat. Can you put your findings in context with global emissions?
There are a number of different sources of methane globally. For example, at the global scale, you know, wetlands are thought to be a really important source of methane to the atmosphere. And there are a number of different anthropogenic sources of methane, for example, coal mines, for example, landfills or wastewater treatment facilities. But in sum total, we think that anthropogenic sources, a.k.a. human-related sources, probably account for 50 to 65% of the global methane budget. And those are numbers taken from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. But I think that there's still an extremely large amount of uncertainty on, you know, how much methane might be coming from different types of sources, for example, from the Arctic versus from the subtropics versus from wetlands, you know, compared to the oil and gas industry. You know, I think this high level of uncertainty is one thing that our study really pinpoints and really, really emphasizes. I think at the moment I would be hesitant to compare Arctic methane emissions against the subtropics, because I think that there's really still a lot that we just don't know.
It does make me wonder, your paper, whether other countries, including Russia, are understating their releases from the natural gas industry. But then I had to ask myself, does Russia even publish such statistics?
One thing that's wonderful about, you know, being in places like the United States and Canada and the European Union is that all of these regions are relatively proactive about measuring concentrations of methane gas in the atmosphere. And these measurements really help us get better estimates of emissions. In the United States, for example, we have about 10 different towers where we measure methane gas. We could have a whole lot more than 10 towers, but, you know, 10 is pretty good, comparatively speaking. In places like Russia, we have almost no measurements of methane gas in the atmosphere. So, in a sense, we don't even really know what's happening there. It's also really interesting that you mention Russia, because back in the early 1990s, we saw globally a pause in the increase of methane gas in the atmosphere. And why the changes in methane gas paused in the 1990s globally is really a scientific question that's received a lot of debate. But a lot of people think that it could have been due to changes in methane emissions from Russia, changes associated with the fall of the Soviet Union, and, you know, how that might have affected natural gas infrastructure and infrastructure there.
Right. Well, as you point out, America is one of the most documented places for things like methane, but I'm betting countries on the verge of a fracking bonanza, like the United Kingdom, for example, have been quoting these lower-than-reality figures provided by the EPA. And Edgar, what do you think about that?
A number of our colleagues in the United Kingdom and in Europe have been looking really closely at methane using the measurements there. People like Alistair Manning, who is at the UK Met Office, and Peter Bergamaschi, who works out of Italy. And they've also been finding methane emissions over those regions that may be higher than government estimates there. So this really is not, this sort of concern about estimating methane emissions and the high levels of uncertainty regarding methane emissions aren't just restricted to the United States, but are also issues in places like the United Kingdom. It's unclear, you know, how this fracking bonanza, you know, in a sense, might affect methane emissions. Our study doesn't really address that particular issue. But I think we need to be careful in our estimates of methane emissions everywhere, the United Kingdom, the European Union, not just in the U.S.
Well, my next question, maybe you can't comment about it as a scientist, but the rest of us do suspect the government may be influenced by the fossil fuel and cattle industries to lowball the methane emissions. Do you personally have the same misgivings?
That's a really good question, and I don't really share a lot of those misgivings. And I would say that it's actually really, really hard to put together these emissions inventories of greenhouse gases. Places like the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and EDGAR is an emissions inventory that's put out by a research center at the European Commission. They basically use an accounting-type measure in order to make up an estimate of methane and greenhouse gas emissions. For example, they'll count up the total number of cows around the United States and in Europe, the total number of oil and gas facilities, total number of landfills, and then try to estimate what are known as emissions factors. So what do we think is the average amount of methane produced by an average cow on a given day, or the amount of methane produced by an average gas facility or average oil facility? You multiply these numbers together, and that add up all of the different parts in order to get a total methane emissions estimate for the United States or for whatever country that you're dealing with. And it turns out doing this is a really, really, really hard problem. You know, it's really hard to count up the total number of cows across the United States or get a strong sense of exactly how much, you know, natural gas is being produced. Natural gas, for example, is information is collected by individual states, and different states have different reporting guidelines. So I think we have to give them credit for, you know, people, places like the EPA, give them some credit for tackling a problem that is really the impossible, trying to answer something, you know, a question that in a sense is really, really difficult for anyone to have an answer to.
Well, I think I like your approach a lot better. I mean, what really matters is how much methane is there in the atmosphere. And if we can measure it in the atmosphere, then we're going to be better off. I'm wondering, during this study or even thinking about these results, did you come across real-world ways we could be reducing methane emissions in order to stave off even more warming?
I don't think our study really gives many specific tips or information as to how we could be reducing methane. But I think that one really important implication that it points out is how uncertain our estimates of greenhouse gas emissions really are. And as I pointed out before, our uncertainty on greenhouse gas emissions is much, much, much higher than the demands of current greenhouse gas reduction policies. If we want to understand greenhouse gas emissions to the extent that's required by proposed regulations, then we really need a whole lot more measurements of methane gas in the atmosphere than we have. And we also really need a really close collaboration between people like myself who do these top-down studies and people like the U.S. EPA and those who construct the EDGAR inventory in order to really bridge those bottom-up accounting type methods with the type of top-down studies that we use. And in the U.S., for example, as I pointed out, we have 10 of these, you know, tall towers where we measure methane. But for a place that's the size of the United States, 10 really isn't a whole lot. And so we'd really like to have many more measurements to at least estimate greenhouse gas emissions to the extent required by policy.
Okay. Our guest has been Dr. Scott Miller from the Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard University. He's part of a team of scientists who just published an important paper showing American government statistics on methane emissions do not reflect what is actually leaking into the atmosphere. You can find a link to that in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you, Dr. Miller.
And thanks again for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Remember prosperity in the new American South? Factories opening, people moving down into the real estate boom? Fortunes may still be made there, but for many people, the system shows signs of eroding away. Robert Leslie is part of a team of artists, writers, and photographers who explored the underbelly of that dream. The result is called Storm Belt. It's a journey across the southern states. Robert Leslie, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad that you have seen the project and have interest in it.
So you're British and sort of Canadian. Why did you choose to chronicle the Great Strip from Miami to Los Angeles?
Well, it was somewhat unexpected. I'd spent through 2007, 2008, I'd done quite a few projects in China. Principally, the last thing I did was for a French Museum of Architecture. I did a project on the development of Chinese urbanization. Having had some exposure to the U.S. in the 70s, when I was based in Canada, I'd never been back over with a camera to take a look at it. So for me, it was an opportunity fresh from seeing the development of the infrastructure of how China is being built up. I had a couple of months spare time, and everything just fell into place for me to go off and do this exploration to take a look at the world superpower, which, as I say in the context of just coming from China was quite astonishing to see what I saw.
We will get to the drought, the storms, and the natural signs, but let's start with the economy. What are some features you noticed in southern decline?
Well, I've done the journey twice. I started the day that Obama became president in Miami, and then I went back at the end of 2011. The initial first third of the trip was much more perspective on the economy because it was the height of the recession, particularly in Miami and throughout Florida, just the number of second homes that were all up for sale. There was an endless amount of holiday homes just completely like make us an offer. And then also going through shopping malls in the parking lots, seeing guys with signs in the entranceway that basically read, "We'll do anything for money." The other thing I kept seeing everywhere was sort of endless improvised yard sales or sales of household materials along the roadside being sold out of vans and such. It was pretty well relentless. There wasn't a day that I didn't see anything like that, that's for sure.
Well, let's move on to Texas. I know Dallas and Houston may do well, but what about rural Texas? What did you find there?
The thing that really struck me about Texas was the amount of abandoned materials. I could find boats in the middle of a field, cars, homes. You know, I had driven past a home, and I'm quite wary of laws about trespassing and all that type of thing. And there's a place that looked like it had been empty for years, and I just thought I'd poke around to take a quick look in it. And I was quite stunned because it's as if the family just got up and left, say, in 1983. There was an Apple computer sort of melted into the floorboards, one of the first Macintoshes. They were an extremely literary family. Amazing books of children's books of the people who built America, other historical books of the story of America, and then all the father suits all hanging up. And it was just strange to see that there was just this amount of abandonment. And I guess what I started to feel was that there was a real sense of like an abandonment of, I guess, the dream or the community or the hope. And I found this really ironic in light of my starting day was the day of Obama's inauguration, and I was in an amphitheater where there was a projection, and the room was just electric with hope and change and excitement. But walk a few blocks down the street in Miami, and then as I saw across the country, it was quite a different story than I saw.
It seems like we could measure the turning of the American South with every great storm. What about Mississippi and Louisiana? Do you feel they really recovered from Hurricane Katrina?
Well, It's interesting. I went back, like I say, the end of 2011, and I had the possibility to meet a few key people. There's a chap, Bill Stallworth, who was instrumental in the rebuilding of Biloxi. But then I'd also talk with people at shopping centers, galleries, streets, just to see how they viewed Katrina and its impact on New Orleans specifically. I was really kind of invigorated by the degree of zeal that people thought that it was actually going to be a good thing, that it was going to make it a stronger city, that it was going to make things more focused. Not everybody had that opinion, but I was really quite surprised by the stubborn determination of people to try to say, okay, we're going to try to fix this up. And I really wasn't expecting that. I didn't see that everywhere. I saw an awful lot of decimated houses and towns that hadn't really been touched in the 4 or 5 years since Katrina. But the thing that left this unexpectedly positive impact on me was the conversations with people there.
But we know in the future, Robert Leslie, that the sea level will rise due to climate change and we'll have bigger storm surges. I kind of doubt Galveston can come back the way it was, or that Miami, that you mentioned, can survive the constant flooding of streets, which are still happening day to day. What's your opinion of that?
It's funny. I think somewhere along the way I may have mentioned that I was connected with the TED organization, and they had a section called TED Fellows, and in there there's a great British researcher named Rachel Armstrong, and she's spent a lot of the last 5 years in Venice trying to come up with ecological systems that can help protect that city from being flooded annually. Yeah, we were aware with melting ice flows that coastal areas will be affected, and it's just strange to see. I always recall sort of histories of indigenous peoples in North and South America sort of avoiding coastal areas because of floods from running waters down the mountains, wiping out villages that might be on the seaside, or the impact of storms. So I think historically, indigenous people have had experiences on how they develop things, but I think all of that was quite overlooked with the rush to modernization and packing as many beach and holiday homes on the coastlines as possible.
And on the other hand, we can hardly talk about Texas without the great drought that is almost permanent. In a video for this work, I saw a single cow lost in the grassless desert amongst the power transmission lines, and I had this awful vision that maybe the oil derricks and refineries will just go on even after nature fails.
Well, in the ebook version of the book, there's one, there's a couple of ghostly scenes, but one of them is just a single oil pump pumping with the sound of like a Harley-Davidson motorcycle engine rumbling. Now, the location of that pump was where the storms Ike and Gustav hit it in late 2008 that totally decimated, eliminated all residential areas, schools, shops, everything. And the only things remaining were the oil pumps. So I think that illustrates a bit what you said right there.
Well, Storm Belt is multimedia. There are searing photos, recordings of people met, and some text about what it all means. Tell us about your co-contributors, would you?
Well, there's the great Canadian environmental landscape photographer, Edward Vertinsky, and a British chap named Cameron Sinclair, who founded something called Architecture for Humanity. I was always aware of Ed's work as a photographer in the same field, but we all got to know each other around 2005-06 through the TED conferences. Both Ed and Cameron were recipients of the TED Prize for the work that they'd done more or less for humanity, and were given a choice to give a wish to implement something in the future. We just found it kind of funny that we'd find each other at different parts of the world several times a year and just had sort of a convergence of thought on sort of where society and the environment was going. And basically, I think the three of us share a desire to bring about change through a type of education. One thing I'm really hoping with the Storm Belt Project is that, well, ironically enough, an old school friend of mine from Canada where I grew up is now a school teacher in Ontario, and she's been using it in some of her classes to stimulate discussion about environmental respect and then other implications of the socioeconomic impact of the choices related to the environment.
You know, it would be great to take this work back to China and say, look, this is where this road goes. Literally, this road goes. Don't go there.
Yeah, well, as with the beach homes, there's this rush to modernize everything, and it doesn't matter if the technologies are beneficial. If they're technologies that have worked for centuries, it's the easiest. It seems to be easier to implement than to turn over a new stone and come about with a different approach. I am kind of curious about going back to China, and I've had, back when I first started working on the book, I had different input of people saying that I should make this sort of A-B comparison over, like, let's say, investment at the beginning of the 21st century in China versus lack of investment in the U.S., but it's all quite political, but I just wanted to stick to the U.S. because I had a much more singular vision in terms of how I was approaching things there. But you're right, you know, the situation with pollution, I've been in China several times, and it's quite shocking in terms of what's happening environmentally.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Robert Leslie, lead author of a new book on the decline of the American South called Storm Belt. Robert, I've got to say, we could tour two different Americas. I'll bet I could cruise through the right circles and find incredible wealth and creativity in the southern states. California is one of the world's biggest economies, and Texas is no slouch. Why do you focus on the negative? Do you think decline is greater than wealth now in America?
I found myself asking this question. I wasn't really seeking out all this stuff. I basically had a rough itinerary of locations I wanted to go to. I didn't want to take any big interstate highways. I wanted to take smaller rural routes. And I suppose psychologically, having the radio on the whole time, listening to the meltdown of General Motors, all of the environmental situations that were going on, but particularly a lot of the stuff about the economy that I was hearing just as Obama was coming in, was, I suppose, affecting my mood and temperament as I went along. And I guess the thing that I felt the further I went was that there seemed to be a real breakdown of a collective community towards trying to make change. You know, a lot of the small shops that were all there through the 50s and 60s run by mom and dad had all been closed up because of the arrival of super malls, which all of those were closing up because the infrastructure to support them wasn't there anymore. And the end result was that you have a lot of disenfranchised families and youth and families running around that are not being able to use their energies the right way. So I wasn't actively seeking out to document negative stuff. I just found it so overwhelming to find it in so many different ways.
When I drove through the southern states last, I felt the militarization of society. You see, lots of guns, plenty of flags, and big bases overflowing with people in uniforms. Did you notice that as well?
Yeah, particularly the area. I actually stayed after I left Miami, I drove up through Tampa, and I stayed with Chris Morris, who's the Time photographer who was covering the White House, and he'd just come from shooting the inauguration. And he's very familiar with the whole Gulf Coast area, and he'd done a few Gulf trips, road trips down through there. He's with the agency 7. And we had a long talk about basically the industries down there, and a lot of the property, a lot of the prime property locations are owned by the military, and consequently, there was a stretch of land that seemed to go for 100 miles that was just continual sort of strip malls that basically supported the people that were working in the military installations. I'd had other situations, too, that I'd go in. A couple of times I had to get new rechargeable batteries for my cameras and stuff, so I'd look for the largest Walmart I could because I figured they'd have the largest inventory of specific pieces that I needed. And in every Walmart, there was a McDonald's, and I'd go into McDonald's because you get free Wi-Fi. And in every McDonald's through the Gulf Coast area there, they'd all have a TV station on, and they would only all be on Fox TV. And I thought that's kind of interesting that if anyone gets exposure to a McDonald's, it's only one sort of media outlet saying one story the whole time. And it seemed to be a unified theme throughout all of the locations I went through the South.
Interesting. Well, it's corporate TV. Well, getting down to it, Robert Leslie, why did you call this multimedia work Storm Belt?
Well, the name was given to me. There was a British chap named Chris Boot, who was a very successful photography book publisher in the UK, and then he was asked to join the Aperture Foundation in New York. And Aperture is essentially the most important, prestigious organization in the U.S. for photography. And he was kind of brought in as a consultant on making the multimedia book. And we'd had different titles, and we ran through a lot of different things, things to do with the Empire, things to do with United, and other things to do with kind of like the loneliness of the long-distance tribe. And then he came out with this word, Stormbelt, out of the blue. And we tried it with other words before and ahead of it, but it just seemed to fit because it was actually Ed Bertinsky who gave me the history of the projections of the Sun Belt, how it was predicted to be the growth area for housing, military, agriculture. And there's been an awful lot of work done, photographically at least, on the decline of the industry of the northern U.S., the Rust Belt. But this was kind of the first kind of comprehensive view of the Sun Belt, which, you know, the Rust Belt was the 1800s and 1900s, and the Sun Belt, and I say the Rust Belt is the previous centuries, the Sun Belt was supposed to be the future centuries.
I'm not sure if you know this, Robert, but some Americans don't take kindly to criticism, especially from foreigners. Do you expect some flames and pushback? Or maybe just self-recognition?
I know. It's kind of like I say, I didn't set out to... This is quite a long tale I could deviate into with this one. I didn't set out to offend people, and I didn't set out to make it as a public book. It was kind of like just a personal observation. It just happens that a few of my friends are very well established in the photography world, and they said, well, you know, this is like a story that should be shown, and you know, the directors of New York Times Magazine and Time Magazine and stuff, they've all seen the work, and I've only had encouragement from those aspects. I do understand that in other parts of society, people will be against it. One kind of very ironic thing is that in the course of being over there on the last journey, I was looking at, let's say, emigrating to the U.S., and I ended up staying one day too long in a year, so I was out for a year and a half, but in that time I applied for an immigration visa, and now I've been granted status as an artist of outstanding merit, exceptional ability to be a full-time resident in the U.S. So we're going to see how that one pans out over the next 12 months.
How do people get the book and the other files that support it?
Initially last year I put out the iTunes version of Stormbelt, which is available on the iTunes stores. It does only work on Apple devices, which would be the iPod or the iPhone and iPad. The print book has now just been released through the British publisher Dowie Lewis. It's going to be available in North America, I think, in late January. It's already available in Europe right now. I think it can be ordered online. And I am looking at doing a version digitally on the Kindle, too, for that kind of device. So I'll have to sort of check to see what possibilities there are for that.
Is there a website for it?
Yes, there's www.storm-belt.com. It's quite simplistic. It has some aspects of the book, excerpts from the essays by Cameron and Ed, a selection of pictures, and a few links to different things on it.
It's pretty moving stuff. The book is out in Britain, Stormbelt, and it's coming soon in America. They say images speak louder than words. These ones shout about the way things are going in the southern states, I think. Robert Leslie, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Alex. Thanks.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You can find more links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. We can only lie to ourselves so long. It's been a fib fest of climate denial and economic black magic. When reality strikes, our confidence-building scripts won't cut it. We become part of nature or fail and fall. What is your decision? I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening. Grab our past programs free at the website, ecoshock.org. Find more links in the weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Please tune in again next week for more Radio EcoShock.